Let's continue a little bit to focus on renewables. I just read a recent report from International Energy Agency called Renewables 2021, and it says that according to their estimates or prognosis for the future, the next 5 years to 2026, they estimate that the growth in renewables would be an increase of almost 95% of the global power capacity that will come only from renewables, according to their estimate. And this resembles 4,800 gigawatts of installed capacity. And that's just to put that in a context, it's about the same as the total installed capacity we have today from all the fossil energy and nuclear. So, of course, this is an estimate, and this kind of starts with the point that we will grow from this from the level of today into the future in this exponential growth of renewables. So, but assuming that would happen, where do you see the next 3 to 5 years in terms of growth in this sector in the renewables? Do you think this is possible? You can also, of course, elaborate on how this would affect the fossil energy market.
Well, first, I think it's important to say that the International Energy Agency has its own agenda, which is very strongly pushing renewables, and that's fine with me. So, but we have to put a little bit of a filter on the sources that we use. And I think that the idea that 95% of the incremental growth in power generation, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about total energy consumption. We're talking about power. It's possible that 95 or 85, I don't, the absolute number doesn't matter. There's no question that most of the incremental, the new installed capacity going forward will be renewable. Okay. But I think the real question there is, forget about the incremental. Let's keep track of how that compares to the total global use. And I think we're still talking about a relatively small number, a growing number for sure. And I'm not trying to disparage it. I'm just trying to put it in a context that makes sense. I mean, so we are, globally, we are, building coal plants, at a horrifying rate around the world, places like, India and Africa and China. I would like to question the IEA on, how, are those included? Are those included or excluded? If a plant is already under construction, but won't be completed for 3 years, is that included or excluded in your 95%? My guess is that it's excluded, and that makes a big difference. But again, I'm not here to try to, to question the IEA. It's just trying to give the viewers a filter to understand it. Let's think about electric power generation as a worker. Okay, so we have coal workers, and we have natural gas workers, and we have solar workers, and we have wind workers. All right, so how many workers, how many solar or wind workers does it take to replace, let's say, a natural gas worker, since natural gas is one of the principal contributors to electric power generation? And based on the physics, it takes about 1,000. It takes 1,000 solar or wind workers to replace one natural gas worker. So if you're a business owner and you have a choice, I have a choice. I can hire one person to come into my company, or I can hire 1,000 people. What is that even a decision that you're going to make? No, it's a ridiculous decision. Give me one instead of 1,000. So that's the physics of it. The physics of it says, yes, you can do this, But you are going to need to dedicate a huge amount of your land mass to wind turbines and solar panels if you expect to succeed at this. And if you're willing to do that, then fine, go ahead and do it. That's just great. If that's a problem, if you don't like to see wind turbines in your backyard, if you don't like the idea of dedicating 25% or so of the land mass of your country to solar panels and wind turbines, then you know, that's great. But that is a factor. Now, the other thing that has to be considered is if we look at the total energy consumption of the world today, in, you know, like looking at fossil versus non-fossil. So we're not just talking about renewables, we're talking about nuclear, hydroelectric, a much bigger community of power generation. That if you remove the fossil piece of that and just look at population, you know, what it takes to support the world's population, the non-fossil component today can only support about 3 billion people on the planet. And as you know, we are close to 8 billion. And so part of the optimistic message from renewable energy is, oh, isn't this great? You know, 95% of all future installed capacity is going to be renewable. And the rest of that sentence is, and 3 or 4 billion people need to die because we simply cannot support the level of population using that form of energy. Nobody talks about that because that's a horrifying thing to think about. And you know, let's say I'm wrong, and I'm just looking at data that, you know, right now, 3 billion people are supported by non-fossil. Okay, let's say that, you know, we can improve the efficiency. Let's say only 1 billion people have to die. I mean, that's an absolutely horrifying thought. And so, you know, you sit in Europe today and you know about the effect of the immigration from places like Syria and Turkey and North Africa and the sorts of disruptive effects that's had on European society and economy. Not all of them bad, by the way. That's the result of a few million people that have chosen or been forced to emigrate into Europe. Well, what if there were 1 billion people or 2 billion people that suddenly could not survive in their countries because of a change in energy consumption? I mean, the level of civil and social unrest that would exist in the world would be unsustainable. And people don't think about this. They don't, I mean, we're talking about human beings who are desperate to eat. They're not going to stay where they are. They're going to go where, if you're comfortable like you and I are in our nice homes in Sweden and the United States, they're going to come here. And that is going to be a hugely disruptive factor. There are going to be wars. If we're talking about the survival or the death of billions of people, you know, people are not going to sit around and just say, oh, well, it's unfortunate, but I guess I'm going to die today. They're going to fight.
You mentioned this from an angle of kind of different energy sources that could lead to these kind of events. But we can just see what's happening right now in terms of the climate change with the migrations connected to that. But I would like to kind of switch the question a little bit, because you mentioned in the beginning, I think you're right physically and so on. Obviously, there's no doubt about it that we can't replace 1,000 workers with one worker or vice versa, as you said. But we need to, regardless of the fossil dependence, we need to change our lifestyle because of the climate as well. I mean, they are connected. So the climate is changing, the planet, as you said, the ecosystem cannot continue like this. We cannot grow in population and we cannot grow in energy consumption. if we are to stay on one planet. We talk about it often here in Sweden and internationally that we live as we had four planets, but we only have one in terms of consumption. So I think you're right in one way, but I would also say that we need to change our lifestyle, and that would also turn out to less energy consumption. If we slow down fundamentally and we change our society, this is a huge transformation. Obviously, it will be difficult in many, many ways, and we cannot have this kind of overconsumption. We buy so much stuff as humans, especially in the wealthier countries. And that in itself, obviously, to change that is very different. But I would say that will just change a little bit the equation. We wouldn't need that much energy as we have today, because we would simply not live in that kind of way. Just something I would like to add. We don't have to...
Let's talk about it, because that's important. So again, I just finished saying, well, if one of the attractive aspects of renewable energy is that life continues pretty much as it has, except for the fact that billions of people need to die. if I propose to most people that we're going to make a change to renewable energy, we're going into an energy transition, and one of the obvious and unavoidable consequences of that is that the best you can hope for is zero economic growth. And the great probability is that we will see negative economic growth going forward. Most people would say, wait a minute. I don't want that. I can't afford that. I have to have growth. I mean, that my whole lifestyle, my whole, everything that I do is dependent on making more money every year. And you're telling me that the best I can hope for is not losing money. And then we have governments. Okay, we are hopefully more than halfway through a pandemic that has cost our collective governments trillions and trillions of dollars. Much of it perhaps spent for very good reason. But debt, currency, requires economic growth, or else currency today is it's a note, it's a debt, and if the value of the currency doesn't increase, then the debt cannot be paid. And so zero economic growth or negative economic growth probably implies an economic collapse, a collapse of the global monetary system, which is unacceptable to governments and to citizens. So, when you say we need to make a change, I agree 100%. But human beings are not going to consciously make a change that results in them being poorer and results potentially in the collapse of their financial system.
In Sweden, we talk a lot about a circular economy, that we have to kind of work towards a more circular economy, that it's both beneficial for the companies, that they make use of all the materials, they don't waste them and so on. I was going to mention it, but I can talk about a little bit here in Sweden, where they're the two biggest mining companies and steel companies have started a project that will produce fossil-free steel using hydrogen. And hydrogen will then be used from hydropower and other renewables, from the hydropower electricity. So the whole kind of the flow will be renewable behind it. So the electricity will be renewable, and the hydrogen will then be used to be able to make the steel and so on. But I agree that this is just a kind of a small example, and it's a pioneering work and so on. And I agree that the economical system as it is today, if we just would turn off the switch, so to speak, and go to renewable over one night, these kind of changes you're talking about, collapse and so on, of the financial system would definitely could happen. So I mean that we have to make this transition as fast as possible, but at the same time changing the whole economic system towards more circular flow and of resources and so on, to step by step kind of changing it. But this is
Well, let's think about that for just a second, though, Johan. Yeah. That a circular economy, which implies reusing more things, which is good, also implies needing fewer new things. Okay, which inevitably leads to a reduction in manufacturing and commerce and economic activity. So the circular economy is a great idea. It makes perfect sense. It's rational. But it also goes back to the point that a circular economy has, at best, a zero economic growth and probably a negative economic growth. And we have to accept the consequences of the circular economy. And most people think that the circular economy is a great idea because life continues just as we're used to it and doesn't involve any sacrifice, and that's simply nonsense. The other thing that's nonsense is that we can decouple energy consumption from economic growth. It's absolute nonsense. And I say it's nonsense not because I disagree with it, it's simply because empirical information says that economic growth has a one-to-one correlation with energy consumption. Yep. Now, if that can somehow change in the future, then that's a great thing. But there's absolutely no evidence to date that is the case. The final point I want to make is that there is such a thing that is called the fossil supply chain to renewables. Renewable energy production requires that we have raw materials. And those raw materials include various minerals. They include steel. They include plastic. I mean, those giant wind turbines that you observe when you drive around the countryside, you know, in any developed country, they're made of plastic. Where does plastic come from? It comes from oil or natural gas. Okay. There's a lot of steel, a lot of metal that is required to build the wind turbine towers, to construct the solar panels. Where does the steel come from? It comes from iron. Iron has to be mined. How is it mined? It's mined with equipment that runs on diesel. All right. We mine these materials and we have to ship them. All right. The global shipping industry is responsible for 80% of world commerce, and it all runs on diesel. And then we go to a factory someplace and we manufacture our solar panels or the diodes or the semiconductors, and that's all done with electricity. And today, you know, more than half, depending on where you are, is generated by coal or natural gas. We have a product. We have to send it to market. How do we do that? We put it on a ship. We use diesel. The ship arrives in a port and it's picked up by trucks. The trucks run on diesel. We take the solar panel, we take the wind turbine someplace to be installed. How do we install it? Diesel. We have earth moving equipment. And so the idea, you know, that the extinction people, that we just need to stop fossil energy today or sooner, means that we also stop all of the components and the manufacture, the transport and distribution of all renewable equipment. So where does that leave us? That leaves us burning candles and living in caves. I just don't think that the vocal and most strident, enthusiastic promoters of renewable energy have any understanding of the system aspect, the complexity of the system that is required to go to a renewable economy. Forget about the economic growth. Forget about that. Just to be able to replace a fossil worker with a renewable worker requires unbelievable amounts of fossil energy today. And so somebody will say, well, you know, that will change in the future. Well, okay, but you know, it won't change quickly. And I always caution the people who question me. They say, well, you know, we'll develop some technology. Well, you know, that's an infantile fantasy. I mean, if it doesn't exist today and nobody knows how to do it, then it's kind of silly to talk about something that is currently non-existent as saving us in the future. That's like saying, well, when we ruin this planet, we'll just move to another one. Oh, well, that's a really good idea.
About this, Arthur, but I agree that, I mean, just to be clear here, I'm not promoting, you know, just turning off all the coal power plants or anything. I'm just saying we need to make the push, and when we talk about innovations, I mean, I'm an investor. I invest in companies in renewables, and what I always look for is people that are pioneers, that look into the future, they address a problem that they want to solve in the renewable sector. Like, for example, this truck behind us, Einride, that's developing a cabinless electric heavy truck. Just a few years ago, people said that the big manufacturers, truck manufacturers, they said to the CEO of this company, Robert Falk, and so on, that this was impossible. You can't make this, and there's technically impossible to make the truck, and so on, and the battery will be too heavy, and so on and so on. Now, a couple of years later, they have proven everyone wrong, and they have just launched in the U.S. and you probably will see them in a not too long future. But of course, an innovation in terms of technology is a different thing than an energy resource. And that's kind of, I think, your core point here, that all the innovation we've had today in the 75 years going back or even longer has been built on the fossil fuel consumption going up. So it has enabled this, we have to be frank, this technical innovation that we have is based on increased use of energy, which has been fossil fuels. So I think you have a very important point that it's naive to say that we can just turn off the switch and go totally renewable and so on. I'm just saying we need to push for it like we do with innovation. And we also have to stop subsidizing a lot of fossil energy today that we have. To go for the fossil energy we need to take, but the one that can't survive, as you said, in the shale oil industry, the companies that are working towards efficiency and super efficiency and are doing good work, so to speak, they obviously, they will stay around. But the companies that are, you know, getting all the money to survive from the state, if we have that kind of logic, we should also support all the innovation in terms of renewables with subsidies, which we haven't. So we need to kind of balance this approach. But I would like...
Let's talk for just a second about subsidies. I mean, a subsidy, by definition, is free money. Okay, it's just, you know, I'm going to give you cash to support what you're doing. Most of what people talk about as subsidies, whether it be fossil or renewable, is not a subsidy. It's a tax credit. Okay, and there's a big difference between a tax credit allowing you to pay lower taxes because you're investing your money in something that the government thinks is useful for the future. And so, I mean, as a private citizen, I mean, I get a tax credit for giving money to charity. I get a tax credit for paying interest on my home payment. Is that a subsidy? I mean, is somebody giving me free money? No. So, I mean, what people talk about as subsidies are just part of doing business. Everybody does it. All of us, you, me, the giant corporations, everybody enjoys tax credits. So I think that the idea of fossil energy subsidies is it's a propaganda talking point that is at least as true for renewable energy as it is for fossil. The other point I want to make is that technology does not create energy. Technology is simply, it's like a straw in a Coca-Cola that better technology allows me to drink the Coca-Cola faster. It doesn't put more Coca-Cola in the glass. The technology allows me to use the Earth's resources faster and perhaps more efficiently, but it never creates any new resources or any new energy. And so again, we look at technology as if it's sort of a god, you know, it's this magic that's going to occur. And the point, and believe me, look at the technology we're using to talk to each other across, you know, 7 time zones and 2 continents and an ocean in between us. It's fantastic. Okay. But it's not free. It all comes at a cost. And if we are simply using technology to maintain the same level of degradation of the Earth's ecosystem, then we are not doing what is right for us.
We'll see if climate change will be able to push us this way or other innovations. But I totally agree. I understand your perspective, and in many ways I agree. But we could talk more about this. But I would like to turn to something else before we finish and talk about the energy crisis, because it's very important. Now we have covered a lot of different aspects of the fossil energy industry versus the renewables and your perspectives on this, which has been really interesting to hear. But now I'd like to look at the energy crisis. It is a global thing. We can talk about it from your perspective in the US and the Europe, but primarily, just to mention, I mean, since June, the global prices of natural gas has tripled. It's gone down the recent 2 months. I noticed that, for example, there's a discrepancy between Europe and the US. So here in the US, here in Europe, the prices has gone down. We're talking now in December, so since October, they've gone down around 15% in terms of natural gas, while in the US, they've gone down 50% over this time, same time period. So they're not as high as they were, you know, in June, but still they are much higher than previously. That's one aspect of it. And there are other aspects contributing to this energy crisis. But how would you explain the energy crisis we're in right now for people not so familiar with the energy market? And perhaps, what do you see as the main driver behind the rising global energy prices? And of course, also the price of electricity.
So first of all, I'd say that there is really only an energy crisis in Europe and East Asia. There is no energy crisis in North America. Natural gas prices have gone higher, but they had nothing to do with events that occurred in Europe or in Asia. They've gone much lower recently. In fact, they were going lower while prices were going higher in Europe and East Asia. So having said that, it's not a global crisis, although it seems like it, because that's what the press calls it. More people click on a global crisis than they do a crisis in Europe. But I'm not disputing that oil prices have gone up tremendously, but that's not a crisis. That's because OPEC and its friends have withheld 10 million barrels a day from the world market. That's a supply, you know, it's a pure conscious supply deprivation that drives prices higher. I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong. That's what has driven oil prices higher. As far as Europe's energy crisis, there are many reasons for it, but the principal reason is terrible policy, absolutely irresponsible policy. Europe has gotten so over-enthusiastic about the potential of renewable energy that it has essentially stopped not only investing in oil and gas, but is closing. I mean, you know, the Groningen field off of the Netherlands, they're closing a field. We don't need that natural gas anymore. I mean, it's still producing 1 billion cubic feet of gas a day. It is declining. We don't need it anymore. We've got wind, we've got solar. In the UK, the last natural gas storage facility was closed in 2019. We don't need it anymore. I mean, how ridiculous is that? This idea that we're so far into an energy transition that we just don't need anything other than renewable energy. And so we have a situation in which there were complications. Russia didn't export as much gas as it ordinarily did or does. We can, you know, be suspicious that Russia's doing it for its own purposes, and maybe that's true, but there are other explanations as well. Russia doesn't have as much natural gas as it needs for its internal purposes. But the bottom line is that, you know, the wind stopped blowing for 5 or 6 weeks because of weather patterns. This happens. I mean, weather is weather, and wind requires wind. Wind energy requires wind, and it didn't happen. And we can, you know, we can graph these tendencies. I've done it here in Texas because we had a, you know, an energy crisis last winter, and before the cold weather ever got here, the wind generation stopped for 3 weeks. Well, 25% of the electric power in Texas is wind, and so we had to increase our generation of coal and natural gas to try to compensate, and it wasn't enough. So these are policy decisions. When we favor, for tax reasons, for subsidy reasons, if you will, you know, we favor renewable energy in the United States. When the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, then the power generators that use coal and natural gas, they have to shut down. They have to turn down their plants so that we can accept all this renewable energy. That costs money. It doesn't take, you know, we don't just instantly turn them on and they're running at 100% when the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining. So I would say that certainly renewable energy is not 100% responsible for the European energy crisis, but it is a major factor. Now in Asia, for reasons that I cannot comprehend, China decided to stop buying coal from Australia, which was its principal supplier. And it thought, well, we can get coal from Indonesia, or we can get coal from, you know, Brazil or something like that. And for a little while it worked, but then there were weather problems in Indonesia, too much rain, there was COVID, and suddenly China had cut itself off from its principal supplier of coal, and its substitute suppliers couldn't deliver. Okay, so now China has an energy crisis. China doesn't produce very much natural gas. And so right now, Europe and China and other places in Asia are competing for the same liquefied natural gas cargoes that, you know, that a place like France or Italy or the UK says, hey, we want to buy a cargo of liquefied natural gas from Qatar or the United States. And they say, great, we'll do it. And then all of a sudden China or Korea says, hey, we'll pay twice as much as those guys. Okay, well, they change course. and the boat goes to Korea. Meanwhile, the price of natural gas goes up, and the Europeans are left with not enough gas. So I think that a major component of the gas crisis is unrealistic and irresponsible planning and policy by the governments, whether they're China, whether they're the EU, it doesn't matter. And that's that, you know, again, that's not a criticism, that's a fact.
It's interesting, you talk about natural gas in Europe and so on. And I know that Russia, they decreased their export, claiming that they needed to have the reserves for the winter storage. And they didn't have enough, so they decreased the export to Europe. And that was, you mentioned that. But another factor is that in the Nordic countries, including Sweden, we've been increasingly integrated our own energy system with Europe. So we're now exporting more to, for example, Germany and Denmark and Finland and Latvia and so on. And the problem here in Sweden is that we have installed more renewables, which is great, but they are intermittent, as you mentioned. So if you don't install a baseload power, like either you have installed capacity in the hydropower plant, which we have, but we have actually decrease that storage. That's a big problem in Sweden. And we have closed reactors, both here in Sweden, nuclear reactors, and in Germany at the same time. So windy days, it's been great. We have an oversupply of energy. And other days, as you mentioned, several weeks, actually 3-4 weeks now, in at least 3 weeks here in Europe, there has been no wind, basically. And then we have a huge problem with the higher electricity prices. So, what I'm thinking about is that we need, of course, to build battery storage, at least for, you know, peak hours. We can actually, it's been working in, for example, in Australia, but that's for, of course, minutes and hours we're talking about, you know. But for the bigger picture, as you mentioned, there's a problem. We need to build storage in order to, either if we have more nuclear. I'm not a promoter for nuclear, but I'm saying that we need baseload power in some form to be able to have more intermittent resources. So I just want to point that out, because that's kind of been a problem here in the Nordic countries and in Europe, as you said. We have integrated our systems, adding more renewables, which is great, but we haven't had a proportionate storage unit in any form, either if it's nuclear, hydro, or what have you, or batteries, which is the new thing, of course. So it's a hard balance.
Well, the only thing I have to add is that battery storage has got its own, I mean, it has its own fossil energy supply chain issues, right? I mean, you don't make a battery out of wind. You make a battery out of lithium and cobalt and copper and all sorts of things that need to be mined, which again today is done principally with oil. So, these are, and it's not cheap, it's not free. You mentioned this, renewable steel plant in Sweden. It's a tiny volume, and hydrogen, for those of the viewers that know anything about EROI a return on energy investment. I mean, green hydrogen is just the worst. I mean, it takes 15 units of input to get one unit out. And so everybody thinks hydrogen is such a great idea. Well, it's a great idea, except it's a great source of energy, except that it's completely non-commercial and it's hugely energy inefficient. So can we do it? Yeah, we can do it. That's great. Is it sustainable? It might be sustainable for you as an investor, your little, arc electric smelting that's run on hydrogen. I hope it makes you a fortune, but it's not a model that applies generally to making steel. I mean, steel requires a lot of heat, and most of that heat comes from coal. I hate to say it. I mean, we don't have a good substitute for coal, and these are just facts. These are, this is the reality that we have to address, and the Extinction Rebellion people, they are energy blind. They have no idea of what I'm talking about.
It's actually in Sweden, they are working on this, that you have, when you have heat that's coming out from factories, we have major industries in Sweden for the steel and so on. They are talking about making use of that, as you said, heat to turn it into hydrogen. And then, of course, in Sweden, we have the advantage of having hydropower for our power generation and also nuclear. But that, of course, as you say, on the global scale, global picture, it is primarily coal plants and so on. So it's a different story in Sweden. But we have to be honest here and say that in Sweden, and it's not that tiny, actually. They're doubling this. They're doing a blueprint of this project in Spain. So these two companies in Sweden are going to use solar energy in Spain and build a fossil-free plant there as well. So, and they are actually quite big, these companies. They're two of Sweden's biggest companies. So, but on a global scale, which I think you're alluding to, they are, of course, tiny. So I'm just mentioning that for people interested in this project, because I think it's still interesting to see how this goes. But I know we have talked a lot, so I'm trying to wrap this up. But just one question I would like to at least add, because we haven't touched upon that. And it's, of course, the price on carbon, which is a hot topic for a lot of people. People talk about that as maybe a way forward to sort of push for other innovation and sort of leveling the play field if we can introduce this on a global scale, which of course you can question. But I would like to hear you your thoughts on how, what do you think on a global price on carbon, you know, assuming that it can be introduced in a fair way, could it be a way for to push for renewables or push fossil companies to go into renewables? Because I'm not saying we're going to, you know, just you know, make all the fossil companies go bankrupt. I want them, of course, to make a change themselves. But how do you see we can go forward? It's a big question, I know, but what are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are simply that if you don't make it economically painful to use less carbon, it's not going to happen. We can debate about the whether a carbon tax is the right way to do it or not. You know, if a carbon tax doesn't result in using less carbon, if it just means I have to pay for it, and you know, I can trade my. I mean, there are lots of important ecosystem and ethical issues around being able to continue to consume carbon as long as I pay for it or trade it on a market. But that notwithstanding, unless we impose some kind of economic pain on using oil and gas and coal, people, they can't stop using it. And it's not because we're stupid, and it's not because we're greedy. All life is based on something called the maximum power principle, which says that people, animals, everything, you know, plants, everything on Earth self-organizes around being able to consume the most amount of energy that is available to it. That growth is not some reflection of human greed. It's a genetic imperative that all life is, for reasons we, you know, metaphysical reasons that we're not going to talk about today, the coding of life is growth. And the currency of evolution is population. And species grow and increase their populations until they encounter a crisis and they either adapt or they become extinct. That's just the history of life on planet Earth. And to expect humans to consciously change our genetic coding towards growth and population increase is absurd. It's just not going to happen. And so the only way that humans will change their behavior is to make the choice painful. Again, we're back to, would you prefer to die or to have zero economic growth? Well, if those are my choices, I'll take zero economic growth any day of the week. But if my choice is zero economic growth versus what I'm used to now, forget it. So I think that's where I stand on that question. That I think we have to do things like carbon taxes. I'm not sure that's the right answer, but and I, you know, even though I disagreed a little bit with your subsidy argument, I see the logic in things like untax. You know, I'm not sure subsidy is the right approach to it, but you know, but one way or another, you know, we need to make it more costly to consume the kind of energy that's destroyed.
Really good ending note. We have talked a lot, Arthur, and I think we could talk for hours. But if there's anything more you want to add, otherwise we can wrap this up. I really enjoy this conversation, Arthur. I think it's good that we disagree, because it's only with this kind of we're not disagreeing that much, but it's the way we have to work forward. You know, if we can't talk about it and be candid and transparent, as you are, very clear about our dependence on fossil fuels, which I totally agree with. There's nothing to debate there, but it's just the way forward. I'm sort of kind of looking at different perspectives, how we can go forward without, of course, crashing both either our financial system or the planet. We have kind of it's the dilemma of our time, obviously. How can we have a good healthy life at the same time as we have a healthy planet? We have to change, obviously, but how do we change in a way that can be acceptable and can happen as soon as possible? That's kind of my thoughts on this. But of course, so if, is it anything more you would like to add?
You can find me on Twitter. It's at AEBerman12. I have a website, artberman.com, which has a lot of free content. And so if you're interested in understanding the details and the background behind many of my opinions that I've expressed today, I assure you that they are based on information. They're based on data. It doesn't mean that they're right, but they're not simply fabrications based on my personal biases and preferences. So I encourage you to follow me and listen to the kind of conversation and debates that I have on Twitter with all sorts of people, many of them from Europe. Many of them I disagree with and they disagree with me, but we have fascinating disagreements. So
yes, and I was going to say that, but good that you brought it up. So I really encourage people to follow you on Twitter and also your homepage. I'll put on the links below for the video, under the video. And you have a lot of interesting perspectives. And also, I don't know if you're going to be on Macro Voices, but there are a lot of interviews there as well. So I can put some links to Macro Voices, a really good podcast in general. I really like it as well. But thank you so much, Artur Berman. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Likewise. Thank you, Johan. All the best.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode as much as I did. I think Artur Berman brings a fundamental understanding to our fossil dependence, while he's very clear that our current use of resources on this planet must change in order to avoid an ecosystem collapse. In some ways, we may disagree, or rather have different knowledge and perspectives on how the role of renewables can play a key part for the future of our planet and help build a new economy. But these types of open-minded discussions is exactly what we need, I think. So share what you think in the comment section below, and we might find a sustainable solution together. And if you like the content and you want to support the show, don't forget, hit the thumbs up button and consider subscribing. In the next episode, I'll probably have the CEO and founder of a Swedish company that is pioneering a battery storage technology for the marine heavy shipping industry, as well as solutions for electric passenger boats, like ferries. So stick around, you don't want to miss that. As always, stay ahead of the curve and stay electric.